Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, sponsored by Exelixis, we had the pleasure of speaking with Raina R. McKay, MD, an associate professor of medicine and a medical oncologist at the University of California, San Diego, to discuss the elements of frontline treatment selection in patients with advanced renal cell carcinoma. In our exclusive interview, McKay discussed the importance of patient selection in advanced renal cell carcinoma, selecting between available combination regimens, and nuances regarding the timing of treatment in this disease. Thank you so much, Dr. McKay, for joining us on an episode of Onc Live On Air to discuss frontline treatment selection in metastatic renal cell carcinoma. Pleasure to have you.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
How do you approach patient selection in the frontline setting in advanced RCC with so many potential options, including that of nivolumab and ipilimumab, cabozantinib and nivolumab, and pembrolizumab and axitinib?
So very good question. Now that we've got several regimens which are approved in the frontline space, there's, you know, a lot of pause that needs to be had regarding which is the best regimen for any one given patient. So the things that need to be taken into consideration when selecting a regimen, I think, is one, what is the patient's risk status? Do they have favorable risk disease? Do they have intermediate? Do they have poor risk disease? I also take into account the patient's burden of disease. Do I think that they're going to be able to potentially make it to second line, or do they need something that needs to work right away pretty urgently? Additionally, I factor in their histology. We know that anybody with sarcomatoid differentiation, possibly also rhabdoid differentiation, can do better with, you know, IO based regimens as opposed to IO VEGF based regimens. So, you know, I think these are all the things that get factored in. Additionally, I think it's sitting down and having a conversation with the patient about what are the goals of therapy? What are the patient's goals of therapy from a quality of life standpoint, from a outcome standpoint? When I think about IO regimens, I think about the CR rates. I think about the durability of this response, long-term durability. There's also the immune-mediated AEs that can happen with IO regimens, and a primary PD rate of about 1 in 5. So I think these are the things that I think about when I'm thinking about IO. With regards to IO-VEGF, you know, they're clearly very efficacious. Response rates are higher. PFS may be longer. I think we're still gaining data regarding durability of the response, long-term benefit. There is the toxicity of chronic TKI therapy that needs to get factored in, and, you know, impacts on quality of life. So, you know, it's weighing those two scales with the two sides of the scale, I guess, for any given patient, and coming to the right therapeutic, you know, decision for each individual.
Do single agent TKIs have a role to play in the frontline setting?
There can be a role for single agent TKI in the frontline setting, though it's increasingly diminishing over time. And, you know, I think the patients who may derive, you know, benefit are probably favorable risk patients. But I think it takes a, you know, discussion regarding, again, goals of therapy. And many of these studies were designed not necessarily with key endpoint of improving, statistically improving outcomes in those with favorable risk disease. So I think when we talk about selection of therapy and use of single agent TKI, there's one thing to be statistically significant, and then there's the other thing, the other notion of being, you know, clinically meaningful benefit in the favorable risk patients. And so when you look at these subgroup analyses by favorable risk patients, a lot of them, I think the studies were really unpowered or not designed to really assess statistical significance in that population. That doesn't necessarily mean that these regimens don't work for patients with favorable risk disease and that Sutent should be selected for patients with favorable risk disease. So I think that that takes a really, like, you know, long discussion with the patients around goals of care. I think in my mind, if somebody has a contraindication to IO, that's when I'm using single agent VEGF. But If I have come to the decision that somebody needs systemic therapy, I want to try to give them the best therapy that's out there. And a lot of trials have now demonstrated that IO combinations are superior to just single agent VEGF inhibition alone.
Do safety and efficacy play an equal role in treatment selection?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, the first question is, you need a regimen that works. So I think I definitely, not to say that I think efficacy trumps safety, but the first question is, the first, you know, goal is, well, does it work? And if it works, then it's, well, what's the safety profile? What's that? If it works, but nobody can stay on therapy, then that's actually not an effective regimen. While it's efficacious, it's not effective. But if it works, but then it also is associated with, you know, tolerability, good quality of life, improvement of cancer-associated symptoms, like that's going to be, you know, a win-win for the patient if you have a safe and effective regimen.
Which endpoints are the most compelling in driving your treatment decisions?
One is durability of response and durability of the benefit. I think that has come largely from, you know, IO regimens like nivolumab and ipilimumab. There seems to be a plateauing of the progression-free survival curve right around 30% that seems to emerge right around 30 months, where there seems to be a subset of patients that really derive great long-term durability, and some patients that can even be discontinued from therapy and they are still without evidence of disease progression. So I think that's been really striking because we've not seen that before. I think we've maybe in the days of IL-2, there is this long tail on the curve in a very, very small select subset of patients, but we seem to have improved that a little bit, certainly from the IL-2 days. So I think that's been striking. I have to say, I think, you know, some of the primary PD rates of a lot of the VEGF regimens, you know, the IO VEGF regimens has been really compelling. You know, drugs like combinations like nivo-cabo, pembrolizumab, lenvatinib, primary PD rates of less than 10%, around 5%, you know, meaning that the majority of patients that are going on therapy are deriving some clinical benefit, where their disease is at least stable or regressing. So I think that's been really exciting from an efficacy standpoint. I think the quality of life data has been provocative, but it's also hard to compare it across study to study, but to demonstrate that at least for some domains, we seem to at least be doing on par with Sutent or better than Sutent with some of the regimens that are approved now.
How might you counter the argument that only around 30% of patients are deriving sustained benefit from a dual immunotherapy regimen?
So I think that's not the clinical benefit rate. So I think the clinical, probably around 80% of patients would derive clinical benefit. I think the response rates are on the order of 40%. I think this is sort of the closest we can get to potentially a cure for somebody. So I think we've never really been talking about cures in advanced renal cell carcinoma for people that have metastatic disease, but there could potentially be a very small subset of patients who could derive long-term, you know, benefit from a stage 4, you know, otherwise terminal illness. So I think that's sort of the, you know, how can we improve that number? How can we make it better than 30%? I think that's where we're all hoping to, you know, gain traction on in the future. But I think the durability of some of the IO VEGF regimens, I think data is still evolving because those studies were a little bit later to report about what's the long-term benefit. Are we actually curing people with IO VEGF regimens? And what's the percentage of that compared to IO-IO? I think those are still questions to be answered.
Going back to patient selection, are there institutional preferences that affect that ultimate decision?
I definitely think that probably has some impact. You know, I think these regimens, it's probably important to, not to say pick one and get familiar with it, but I think it's important to be familiar with how to use these regimens in clinical practice because they're not without their toxicity, like specifically lenvatinib, pembrolizumab, you know, it's associated with increased rates of grade 3-4 toxicity and even death in very small number of patients, but, you know, it's not, you know, without its adverse side effects. So I think it requires a clinical care team that is equipped to be able to handle those side effects. So I think, you know, having a multidisciplinary team where, you know, the the person doing triage and taking in calls and handling messages and the education to the patient and communication to the patient. And you know, if the patient were to go into the ED, making sure that there's clear communication across all of those spheres on how to, you know, handle, you know, toxicity associated with any regimen. So I think, you know, with regards to institutional practice, it's an institution's experience and comfort in being able to handle all that, you know, I think definitely weighs in, you know, selecting one versus another.
Does second line sequencing play a major role in what you recommend to a patient upfront?
When I'm making the decision for first line, I want to make sure that the patient gets the best regimen for them at that moment. The comment regarding whether I think somebody would make it to second line is, you know, more so targeted that are they so sick that I can't afford a 1 in 5 PD rate? Like, are they so sick that I'm worried that if they progress, they're not going to ever see something else? That's where I think the IO-VEGF regimens have really been kind of game changer. Because the PD rates are so low, the primary PD rates are so low. So the most of the patients benefit. The question is, how long do they benefit? Is it months, years, several years, beyond 5 years? You know, that's, I think, to be determined.
Have any of these considerations changed or become magnified during the COVID-19 pandemic?
I do think so. Frequency of visits, I think, is, you know, something that's come up. Obviously, telehealth, telemedicine, and being able to care for patients, you know, away from home, not bringing them into the cancer center as frequently as you otherwise would. So I think that all, you know, will play into the regimen that gets utilized. You know, pembrolizumab now has Q6-week dosing, and you could conceivably see patients in the clinic less frequently. That doesn't mean don't monitor them less frequently, still monitor them as you would with labs and maybe telehealth visits, but physically coming into the clinic, you know, you can space things out. So I do think that it had played into, you know, how operations were being handled for newly diagnosed patients. But I think, you know, now we're kind of beginning to see the light at the end of the tunnel, but patients are getting vaccinated, but I think it's going to be something that's going to continue to have a long-term impact on how we practice medicine in the future.
We also saw data from the CLEAR trial earlier this year. If pembrolizumab plus lenvatinib is approved in the frontline setting, will that affect how you approach treatment selection upfront?
Lenvatinib and pembrolizumab is an incredibly effective regimen. I mean, the PFS was around 24 months and the complete response rate was 16%. It was an incredibly efficacious regimen, but it's probably, you know, again, we can't necessarily compare head to head. It was associated with significant toxicity. Patients were on therapy longer, so they had more time to, you know, have toxicity, but the bulk of patients required dose reductions. And there was also, you know, some deaths that were observed that were treatment related. So I think that that needs to be discussed with the patient. And I think clinicians need to closely monitor patients and feel comfortable with the regimen, giving the regimen and titrating the doses according to label. So I think the data are very exciting and the data are impressive, but are we going to see that good data out of the context of a trial in the community and clinical practice? You know, that's what I worry about.
At what point after discussing frontline options with patients should treatment be initiated?
With regards to systemic therapy for metastatic disease, not every individual needs immediate initiation of systemic therapy. So if somebody is favorable risk, they present with very low volume lung metastases that aren't necessarily amenable to resection, but they're small and, you know, about a centimeter in size, like you don't, and they're otherwise, you know, healthy with a great performance status and again, favorable risk, you don't necessarily need to initiate treatment immediately. And there is data to support active surveillance for some patients who have advanced disease, though it's a minority of patients. You know, for patients that are intermediate or poor risk, or even if they are favorable, but maybe have a higher disease burden, that's sort of when we begin to initiate the discussion regarding frontline systemic therapy options.
And patients with bone metastases represent a subset of those with advanced RCC. Apart from systemic therapy, what other modalities may be helpful to these patients?
So patients with bone metastases represent about a third of patients who have advanced renal cell carcinoma. And these patients are a particularly increased risk of morbidity related to the bone metastases, given that it can impact quality of life, cause pain, fractures, need for surgery or radiation. And multiple studies have demonstrated that patients who have bone metastases have worse prognosis than patients who don't have bone metastases. You know, cabozantinib has certainly demonstrated efficacy for patients who have bone metastases, and we're currently conducting a trial through the cooperative groups through the alliance called RADICAL that's testing cabozantinib with radium-223, which is a liquid radiopharmaceutical that specifically targets areas of bone turnover in the bone. And so this trial is really designed to try to improve outcomes for patients who have bone metastases.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive on Air, sponsored by Exelixis. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLive SOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive on Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive on Air.